अवधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ओम्
This prayer, by the way, which I just recited now, is it's customary to chant it before studying the Kathopanishad. Each Veda has its own prayer. So this is from the Yajur Veda. It means we're praying to the Lord to protect us all, the teacher and the taught, by giving us spiritual knowledge, realization that we are Brahman. To nourish us by the results of that knowledge. What will be the results of that knowledge? Remember, the whole project is to overcome suffering and to get true happiness. So getting that would be a proof that we are getting the result of this study. And let this study be invigorating. Give us strength to face life. Real spiritual strength. And also let it be luminous. That we read and we grasp and we... and it becomes a living truth for us. And may there be no disharmony amongst us. So that's the prayer. Om, peace, peace, peace. All right. This session, my main task will be to keep you all awake. Not a problem for on my side because I'm speaking. It's much more difficult to be awake when you're sitting and listening passively. So what we will do is we'll make it more interactive. So I'm going to give short breaks in between where we can talk it out. I'm going to speak about a section. When I've covered one point sufficiently, we'll talk about it. Then we'll go on to the next point. So that's what we're going to do. So we have chosen, exercised our power of choice, and we have decided to lead a spiritual life. Well and good, but it's not that easy. Have you ever wondered why it's so difficult to change? All these books, the self-help sections of big bookshops, and there are all these shiny new titles every year. And it's a big business, especially self-help books. People keep buying these books. And it's not that these books are not valid. They have got wisdom in them. They have got something that works in them. But why is it that it doesn't make much of a difference to our lives? All of us, we have read books on, most of us at least, on how to be happy, how to overcome anxiety. What was that? How to win friends and influence people. And Stephen Covey, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Many of them were truly wonderful ideas, really. And we understand it. And not only do we understand it, we want to implement it in our own lives and make a change. But then thing happens is that we really don't change much. Why not? Why is it so difficult? Even after we have made the choice, and we are not like Duryodhana who is not willing to change. We are willing to change. We really want to change our lives. We are open to wisdom. It's from positive psychology or from religion or philosophy, wherever. Now there is a book about that. Did you know that? Obviously there is. It's called The Happiness Hypothesis. It sounded like one of those many titles, new titles on positive psychology. But this is, it was a refreshingly serious work. Professor Jonathan Haidt, I don't know how you pronounce it, H-A-I-D-T, Haidt. He's a professor here somewhere in the United States, working in the field of positive psychology. He wrote this book, The Happiness Hypothesis, where he raises this question. Why do we find it so difficult to change even if we want to? Even when we know how to. We have read the Upanishads, we have read Vedanta, we have read positive psychology and so many self-help books. But why is it so difficult? And the answer he gives is very interesting. He says, when you read something, listen to a lecture, you're convinced of something that you need to do yoga or meditation or philosophy or whatever. What is convinced? It's our intellect that's convinced. Our intellect is convinced. But we are not just intellect. We are bodies. We are emotions. We are habits. He gives an example, very interesting example, and that's very relevant to what Yama, the Lord of Death, will say next. He says, imagine, this is the professor Jonathan Haidt, not the Lord of Death, says, imagine an elephant and its rider, the Mahout. Mahout is the rider of the elephant. And the Mahout decides where to go, and he's got a map, a GPS, he knows where to go. And he has made up his mind. Now he'll be able to go there, he'll be able to take the elephant there only to the extent that the elephant is willing to go there. The elephant is much stronger than the Mahout. So if the elephant listens to the Mahout and obeys the commands, the Mahout will reach. But if the elephant is not interested in going there, if the elephant doesn't want to go there, the Mahout is not strong enough to drag the elephant there. Impossible. Exactly the same thing happens, you know, in our case. Just as the Mahout understands the map or the GPS and he knows where to go, the intellect understands. Yoga is good for me. Getting up early and meditating is good for me. Reading spiritual texts and practicing them, it's good for me. But the elephant, the body, it doesn't care. It doesn't understand lectures. It's like that elephant. It's a creature of habit. It doesn't understand lectures. It doesn't understand high philosophy. It doesn't understand Vedanta or positive psychology or Walter Mischel or the marshmallow test. Nothing. None of this. Now, Jonathan Haidt points out, what does it understand and what can we do about it? Any number of lectures, your intellect is thoroughly convinced, but the body does not respond to that. So I may be thinking that getting up early in the morning and doing yoga is good for me, and I agree, and I understand, and I want to do it, I decide to do it, I resolve to do it. But early in the morning at 5 o'clock when the alarm goes off, then it's not the intellect who is in charge, it's the body. And the body says, hit the snooze button. 10 more minutes. So there's this little cartoon of the Star Wars character Yoda, who's this archetypical wise person. And so he opens his eyes in one picture, and the subtitle said, The Force Awakens. And then he has a funny way of closing his eyes like this. And then the subtitle below that says, The Force Wants 10 More Minutes. So that's what happens. Now, what can we do about this? This understanding has to be there first. That the Mahout may understand, the intellect may understand, but the body or the elephant does not understand. Now Jonathan Haidt asks, what does the elephant respond to? In the case of the elephant, what does the elephant respond to? The elephant responds to training. The elephant responds to training. How are elephants trained? They're given a training through incentives, discipline, not by lectures. You can lecture to the elephant day after day. It will not make any difference to the elephant. In the same way, the body responds to training. The body responds to training. Let's just see what the Lord of Death has to say about this. Keep the elephant image of Jonathan Haidt. 21st century, he says this. 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, the Lord of Death in the Katha Upanishad speaking to Nachiketa. You want a spiritual life? Nachiketa says, yes, that's what I'm here for. And then he says, consider this. He says, Atmanam rathinam viddhi shariram ratham evatu manah pragraham buddhim tu sarathim viddhi manah pragraham evacha Indriyani hayan ahur vishayangsteshu gocharan atmindriya mano yuktam bhoktityahur manishina. Two verses. He gives us a model. He says, consider this body to be a chariot. Today he would have said, Cadillac or something like that. Not Cadillac. Cadillac is so 1970s. He would have said something like a Prius or something like that, you know? Tesla. Though most bodies are not Teslas. So, consider the body to be a car, a chariot. And you are the passenger. You, the self. You are the passenger in this body. Okay? I'm the passenger. Who's driving? You are not driving. In the driver's seat is the intellect, is the buddhi, the intellect. And the steering wheel is the mind, which executes decisions. The steering wheel is the mind. And the, you know, the, it works with the chariot example. We have five horses. Five horses are the five sense organs. And they run, it's a strange kind of chariot, it runs simultaneously on five lanes. So, the lanes are the five sense objects. Eyes are the horses, and the forms are the lanes it runs on. Ears are the horses, and it runs on the lane of sound. Ears hear sound. So touch, sparsha, its skin is the organ of touch, and you touch things. And nose smells things, and the tongue tastes things. So taste and touch and smell and forms and sounds, these are the lanes on which our sense organs are running. They are the horses of your chariot. Something like the wheels of a car. Though you'll be in deep trouble if they run on different lanes, but and it's controlled by the wheel, which is the mind, and the wheel is in the hands of the intellect, the knowing faculty, the understanding. And you are the passenger. The self, in conjunction, when it is sitting in the car of this body, it's called the enjoyer or the experiencer. What we find ourselves to be right now is not the pure self in itself. We find ourselves to be embodied selves. You're in a car, basically. And the problem is, we've forgotten what we are. We have taken ourselves to be the car. And now he's giving us a model to understand what's happening in our lives. Consider yourselves to be the consciousness within the body. And there's a guy who's at the wheel of the car. That's your intellect. You are not the intellect. You're the passenger in the back seat. And the mind is the one through which the intellect operates, thinks, decides, and choice. And these sense organs are acting in the world outside. The mind controls the sense organs. It's a basic imagery. But do you see how it corresponds to the elephant and the rider image? It's a more sophisticated model, but it corresponds to the elephant and the rider image. The rider, the mahout of the elephant, would be something like the intellect which drives this car, the driver of the car. Okay. And now he says,
yastu avijnanavan bhavati ayuktena manasa sada tasindriyani avashyani dushtashvaiva sarate.
If the driver is drunk, if the wheels are loose, the wheel of your car is not aligned, and the wheels on which the car is running, the horses of your chariot, they tend to run in different directions. They do whatever they like. They are not well trained. The passenger will not reach his destination, to say the least. He'll end up getting a ticket, definitely. So, he says, if the intellect is not well informed, is not knowledgeable, if the mind is not mindful, ayukta, mindful, is not mindful, and the indriyas, the sense organs are not trained, they are willful, they tend to run in their own. Each of them has an autonomous intelligence. Now, Jonathan Haidt also says something very interesting. He says the body has its own autonomous intelligence. It's a low-grade intelligence. It doesn't do math or calculus or do philosophy. But it has a certain amount of understanding. Nowadays, modern medicine is coming to this understanding. Even our gut feeling, we keep talking about gut feeling. They say there are actually bacteria there which influence our moods in our gut. So different centers, wherever there are strong plexuses, concentrations of nerve centers, there's a kind of autonomous low-grade intelligence there. It has certain likes and dislikes. It wants to go one way, which is pleasant for it. So eyes want to see what is pleasant. Skin wants to touch what is nice for it. Tongue definitely wants to taste what is pleasant for it. Evolution, habit, all of these together have programmed these sense organs. Unless we reprogram them, we are in trouble. We will continuously have conflicts. We will read books, listen to lectures, but when it's time to do something, we run up against these horses which are not listening to the charioteer, this vehicle which is not responding to the commands of the driver. The intellect is convinced. To first of all, when we read books and listen to philosophy lectures, think about it, slowly we understand. We get some mature understanding of what life is, what we are and what we are supposed to do, what will make us happy. Then we run into these obstacles. These obstacles are of our own creation. These habits which we have ingrained, patterns of thinking. Mind, he says, if the mind is not mindful, this whole thing about mindfulness meditation. You see, most of the time, we are not in the present. If you see on a movie screen a person walking and there's a banana peel and the person slips and falls, slapstick comedy. It's cruel, but we laugh at it. And then the person falls and we think it's funny, though it's very cruel to do that. But we are doing all of us are doing the same thing. All the time we are slipping on the banana peel of time, you know, slipping off into the future. What if this happens? Anxieties, expectations, thinking about what will happen next. Or slip back into the past. If only, it's called the if only think. If only I'd said that, if only I'd done that, if only. Past. What if the future? We are slipping on the banana peel of time and slipping off away from the present. Unmindful. So the mind has to be mindful, fixed. Today in the morning I was giving this example of the windshield wiper. So if you do that, the mind is unmindful. Mind has to be focused on the road when you are driving. So in the same way, he says, if the mind is not mindful, if the intellect is not knowledgeable, your GPS is not programmed, the intellect is not knowledgeable, driver doesn't know where he's going, and the horses are not well trained, this passenger, you the self, you will not reach the goal of overcoming suffering and attainment of bliss. On the other hand, yastu vijnanavan bhavati yuktena manasa sada tasindriyani vashyani sadashva ivasarathe. But the one whose intellect is well informed, you attended all the Vedanta classes, and mind is concentrated, aware. That's the next thing. Attending Vedanta classes, reading books, hearing lectures. You see, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, we come across a place where people are talking about Vedanta, discussing Vedanta. And Sri Ramakrishna is sitting on his cot and listening to them. And then he says in Bengali, I'll translate for you. He says in Bengali, Kotha gulo to bhalo, dharona hawa chai. The words are very good. What you're saying is very good, but it must be assimilated. The mind must be able to assimilate it. So, the intellect is fully aware of Vedanta. The mind is concentrated, able to assimilate what you have understood. And you soak in it, marinate in it, so that it becomes part of your life. Swami Vivekananda says, tell yourself again and again that I am that, or I am he, I am that, till it tingles with every drop of your blood. That I am not flesh and blood, I am spirit, till it tingles with every drop of your blood. So that is when the mind becomes focused. And he says, our sense organs are well trained. For that person, he will attain the goal of spiritual life. Here comes the question of spiritual practice. I'll complete this point and then we'll discuss it a little bit. We have a lot of confusion regarding spiritual practice. You see, Vedanta says basically, we are one with the divine. And what is the problem? We do not know it. Not knowing is the problem. Not knowing is equal to ignorance. Not knowing itself means ignorance. And ignorance can only be overcome by knowledge. Ignorance can only be overcome by knowledge. Hence the importance of what is called Jnana Yoga, the path of knowledge. So ignorance is overcome by knowledge. What is the path of knowledge? First of all, you study these texts. The very word Upanishad, in the first talk I did not actually give you the meaning of the word Upanishad. I gave you the meaning of the word Vedanta. Vedanta means Upanishad. But what does Upanishad mean? The word itself. It means knowledge. The word itself has three parts. Upa, Ni, Sat. Upa means approaching this knowledge Or literally it means going to a teacher, going to these texts and getting this knowledge. Upa. Ni means deliberating on this knowledge till you get conviction. And Sat is the result of this knowledge. What is the result of this knowledge? I'm giving you Shankaracharya's commentary. He says the result of this knowledge is threefold. One is, number one, it destroys. It destroys what? It destroys ignorance. Knowledge destroys ignorance. We did not know that we are Brahman. Now we will begin to understand, feel, appreciate the fact that we are spirit, not flesh and blood. Second, it takes you to Brahman. What takes you to Brahman literally, what does it mean? How does it take you? Spiritual journey is not a physical journey. You don't have to go on a pilgrimage or something. Takes you to Brahman means we realize that we are Brahman. This gap that I am a puny human creature, mortal creature, the death, the big problem, this is transcended by the realization that I am not that puny mortal creature. The body will die, but I am immortal. This journey is taking you to Brahman. And the third effect is it loosens the hold that the world has on you. The suffering is because the world has a hold on us. Every little, you know, pinprick makes me feel pain. Every little ache in the body, every insulting word, every little downturn in the fortunes of my day-to-day life or even the stock market makes me feel bad. I am at the mercy of everything. Swami Vivekananda put it very harshly. He said, slave to the passions of the body, slave to every little whim, slave to an unkind word. We are enslaved by this world. So it loosens the grasp of this world on us. It frees us from these clutches, this knowledge. So what does this knowledge do? Three things. It destroys ignorance, takes us to Brahman, meaning we realize we are Brahman, and finally, it loosens the grasp of samsara upon us. This is the threefold result. And how do you do that? You come to this knowledge first, upa, coming to the knowledge. Study it, listen to the talk, come to a competent teacher, come to the Vedanta Society and attend retreats on Kathopanishad. Yes, it's part of it. You may be happy to know that this is part of, you have already started spiritual practice. In the path of knowledge, it's called in Sanskrit, Shravana. We generally have a feeling, okay, I've heard the lecture, now let me do it. That's a good idea. But even hearing the lecture, understanding is already doing it. You've already started, so congratulations. You've already gone one third of the way, maybe. And the second thing is, they say manana, to assimilate this truth, to think about it again and again. Apart from studying and listening to lectures, trying to live up to this truth, to assimilate this truth. And finally, nididhyasana, to meditate upon this truth till it becomes a living reality. Three stages. Study, reflection, meditation. What does study do? It removes our ignorance. We begin to understand that such a thing is possible. Then reflection, what does it do? The doubts will come. When you read all this, then many, many questions will come. You see, after every class, we have a question answer session. So many, many questions will and should come. If they haven't come, then there's something wrong. Questions should come. Because the Vedanta says we are in ignorance and it's trying to take us to a state of knowledge. If we are in ignorance, there's something wrong with our thinking. And when you hit that wrong thinking, questions will arise. I think this way, you are telling me I'm wrong. Tell me why. In each point, I'll ask a question. So these questions, deliberating upon it, at the end of the period of reflection, what do you expect? You expect conviction. At the end of the first period, what do you expect? The period of study? You expect knowledge. Okay, the book tells me this. The Swami tells me this. This much. But, what's the but there? But I have questions. I have doubts. At the end of the second period of reflection, what happens? The Swami told me this. The books told me this. I had doubts. Now we have gone through all of those doubts. I am beginning to get convinced. I understand now. I'm getting it now. That's the end of the second phase. Then what remains after you get it? It's still not a living reality for me. I know what the book says. I now believe it. I'm convinced about it. But it's still not a living reality. It still doesn't help me to overcome suffering and attain bliss. So that comes through the period of meditation upon what you have heard and you're convinced. You can't jump straight to meditation and say, meditation is a real thing. Let me say, I won't listen to any classes. I'll sit and meditate in the temple. That comes only after you have gone through this process. So this is the path of knowledge. Now a doubt will come. Swami, I have been coming to the Vedanta Society for 30 years. I still am not enlightened. Then Sri Ramakrishna is saying, Katha gulo bhalo, dharana hawa chai. He says, see, these things have to be absorbed. Vedanta says, now the problem is not at the level of the intellect. The problem is at the level of the mind. The mind has to be, as Yama said, samanaska, that means mindful. You need concentration of mind. So through meditation, through worship, upasana, the Sanskrit word is upasana, it develops concentration on a spiritual subject. Focus, concentration. That is the stage, that is where the mind is concentrated. So, Swami, I have taken the sacred mantra and I have been doing the japa and meditation for decades, but mind is still not concentrated. How do you know that? Every spiritual retreat there will be a question. Swami, when I try to meditate, my mind goes here and there, which means the mind is not concentrated. Then why does that happen? The third and final stage, I mean the foundation of all of this. The mind is not concentrated, it goes here and there because of the impurities that we have poured into the mind year after year throughout our lives. So that is called, there we need chitta shuddhi, purification of the mind. Look at the way Yama has said. Three things he says. One is the sense organs need to be controlled. Second, he says the mind has to be mindful. And third, he says the intellect has to be knowledgeable. You can now match it. The intellect at that level, jnana yoga, the path of knowledge. At the level of the mind, meditation and devotion, bhakti yoga and raja yoga, they will work. And at the level of the action of the sense organs in the world, karma yoga works. Chitta shuddhi. So karma yoga, the path of action, it purifies the mind. With a purified mind, when we try to meditate, we get a concentrated, purified and concentrated mind. With a purified and concentrated mind, when we come to the Upanishads, the Vedanta, the philosophy of the Upanishads, then it works. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Hearing, reflection and deep meditation on what you have heard and reflected upon. Then comes what is called the direct intuitive knowledge that we are Brahman. Direct knowledge, not just reading about it. We realize it. It becomes a living reality. Unless we do that preliminary part, controlling the sense organs, purifying our mind, number one, mindfulness, samanaska, concentrating the mind through bhakti and through meditation practices, number two, unless we do that, this philosophy of the Vedanta, the Upanishads, you know, one Swami told me that unless you have what is called sadhan chatushtay, the preliminary qualifications for Vedanta, unless we have that, what will happen is at the end of all of this, you will feel you have read a particularly clever philosophy. A very interesting philosophy, and you have read something that's very interesting, but it didn't make a difference to your life. That's why after lecture sometimes, as you see students, you know, they're impatient, young people. Swami, I heard what you said, it didn't work. You know, you just like you read it and then you take it out for a spin. It's not like you purchased a car from the showroom. It won't work. You have not got the keys to the car yet. First, you need to clean up house. And then you need to focus the mind. And then with that focused and clean mind, when you come here, it works. Now, do you need to do that first, one by one? No, that's a lifetime's work. Do I need to do lots of good deeds to lots of people for 50 years? And then meditate for 20 years, and then come to classes for 10 years, it will be too late. You need to do all of it together. That's why Swami Vivekananda recommended the harmony of four yogas. Karma yoga, bhakti yoga, raja yoga, and jnana yoga. Raja yoga is meditation. Bhakti yoga is love and devotion to God in whatever form the guru has taught you. And karma yoga is the path of good works which purifies the mind. I'll stop here. Do you have any questions about, this is a very important part about spiritual practice and Vedanta. What's the relationship of practice, different kinds of practice, what results do you expect from those kinds of practice and Vedanta? Yeah, there's a question.
Quick question. So as you were talking about the reading and the reflection and the meditation.
Yes.
Three things are happening, right? So your, the knowledge comes and ignored, destroys ignorance.
Yes.
No, you get closer to Brahman.
Yes.
And then the external world grasps, loses.
Yes.
So that's very true, and I feel that, right? But as the outcome of that,
yeah.
Don't you think it's a, so if every person starts doing that, isn't it a bit more selfish from that person's perspective versus helping others?
True, but only two things. One is, that person will also be helping others because he or she needs to practice karma yoga. You see, the fundamental practice at the foundation is karma yoga. What I have said, a three-tiered practice. You can make notes about it also. You can say problem, practice, result. Problem, impurity of the mind. Practice, karma yoga, the path of good deeds. Result, purification of the mind. Sanskrit, chitta shuddhi. Next level, one step up. Problem, the Sanskrit say vikshepa, scatteredness of the mind. Mind is not, so mind is scattered. It's unable to absorb these truths. Practice, meditation and devotion. Raja yoga, bhakti yoga. Result, concentration of mind. Focus, mindfulness. Now you have a pure mind and a mindful mind, a concentrated mind. With that, when you go to the third level, problem, ignorance. Practice, jnana yoga, the path of knowledge. Result, knowledge, enlightenment. Now remember, this kind of classification is entirely from the path of knowledge point of view. They have privileged the path of knowledge above everything else. You see, jnana yoga is at the top. Bhakti and devotion and meditation are in the middle. And the path of works is at the bottom. Now this is because this is from the Advaita Vedanta point of view, the path of non-dual Vedanta. This is one way. This is one way of looking at it. But remember, that even in this way, even in the path of knowledge, they cannot dispense with work. You cannot dispense with devotion. You cannot dispense with meditation. They just give it a lower status than knowledge. Knowledge is final. From knowledge alone comes enlightenment. Knowledge itself is enlightenment, and from that comes freedom. But freedom from suffering and attainment of bliss. But all the other practices are maintained. There are some teachers who say only knowledge is required, as if to say you don't need devotion, you don't need to do unselfish work, you don't need to meditate. Well, in that case, it generally doesn't work. Even people who follow it sincerely, they'll end up feeling we have read many books, we have understood many things, but sorrow doesn't go away. Suffering doesn't go away from life. So it's just remains at a kind of understanding. Intellectual understanding. That very intellectual understanding can be deepened into spiritual realization only when the supporting spiritual practices are present. Yes. So, karma yoga is there. It will not be a selfish person. Not only that, moment one thinks along these lines, that I am not the body and mind, imagine where selfishness comes in. Selfishness comes in with a deep body idea. I am this little body. If I am this little body, then what Dr. Becker said, the denial of death and the fear of death and our immortality projects, everything for myself, somehow to perpetuate this individual being. Schopenhauer, the great German philosopher, he says, a very interesting person, Arthur Schopenhauer, he says, to desire immortality for the individual is to seek to perpetuate an error. Is to eternally perpetuate an error. The individual is an error. We are not separate little beings. There is some background unity to all of us. That spiritual unity. That is what is immortal. This individual is not immortal. We are immortal as that background consciousness or spirit. That's what we have to realize ourselves as. Not as this limited being of flesh and blood. This will die. Even the most spiritual, most person who has attended the largest number of Vedanta classes also will die. You can't help it. The body will die. But the advantage is, when you realize yourself as something not this body and mind, you are free of it. You are free of it. So, selfishness usually should not come. If selfishness is coming, there is something wrong with my understanding. Yes, in spiritual life, a certain amount of stepping back is necessary. So you will spend some time in study, in contemplation, in meditation, in solitude. But that makes you a better person. That makes you a better person. Yes. Questions about spiritual practice, there's a question there. Okay. Okay. The feedback is there. I can hear you. I can hear you. Yeah.
Can you repeat the problem solution?
Yeah. Outcome? Make a three-tier structure.
Yeah.
So you have a problem. You have a problem. You have a practice, a solution, and a result. Three columns. At the bottom, at the beginning, the main problem is impurity of the mind. Various kinds of vasanas, samskaras, the default programming which we have got in our minds, because of which that monk was putting black pebbles. So that's there. See, if we had a pure mind to begin with, if we were saints to begin with, you wouldn't need all this. You'd go straight to God. And there are such people. Maybe because of past lives. Once in a while you come across a genuinely wonderful spiritual person. Because I was in charge, I was charged with training, with teaching young men who had come to become monks. I would see once in a while in every other batch of people, all of us were more or less idealistic young people. But once in a while would come along a person who takes to monastic life like fish to water, like ducks to water. You know? They're just meant for it. It's like born saint or something. Now, how does that happen? Because they have cultivated it maybe in past lives. They have got none of their programming clashes with what they're supposed to do in this life. But it's wonderful to see. And they may be far junior to me. They were newcomers. But I could see, maybe I know the books, I know the texts, I can teach that. But in spiritual life, they could teach me. Because their habits, their thought processes, their feelings, emotions are all way up there. So that's the first stage, purification. The practice for that is karma yoga. The result of that is purity of mind, chitta shuddhi. Where evil passions, negative thought patterns, weaknesses are transcended. We have a new programming in place. Second level. Problem, mind is scattered, not concentrated. Practice, meditation and bhakti. Meditation and devotion. Meditation is the practice of learning to focus the mind at one place. Instead of that monkey thinking, jumping around from tree to tree, focus at one place. Hold your focus. And bhakti is, we have the enormous power of love, of desire. Bhakti is just replacing the object of desire. I desire and love the world. Take the world away and put God there. I desire and love God. Easier said than done. But there's an enormous power. Desire, the heart, is more powerful than the intellect. We may understand something, but what we'll finally do is what we want to do. Wanting and understanding are two different things. So purifying the wanting is not to stop wanting, but to replace the object of wanting. Why should you stop wanting? Wanting, desiring, passion, this is power in life. This is what propels us forward. If that is there, if you've got passion about anything, you will feel alive, moving forward. If you stop it, you'll just feel like the fire has gone out of life. So keep that passion alive. But Sri Ramakrishna used to say in Bengali, "Mod phiriyede," turn the course. The surging river is going there. You turn the surging. You don't have to dry up the river. Don't do that. You have to turn the course of the river. I went to see Hoover Dam. They took me to see the Hoover Dam. There's this river, Colorado River, which used to play havoc in the southern states. In 1920s, the US government, the seven states got together, they divided the water among themselves and they made this huge dam. It was the biggest dam at that time in 1920s. Now what it did was, it channelized the water. Now that water which was dangerous, now became useful. It serves our purpose. Similarly, this the stream of life coursing through us is dammed up by and channeled by meditation and devotion. The second stage. What will be the result of that? Concentration of mind, of desires also, on God. And then the final stage. What is the problem? Ignorance. Ignorance about what? Not physics, chemistry, or biology. or mathematics or something. It's ignorance about our true nature. We do not know who we are. Ignorance. Solution? Any ignorance is removed only by knowledge. What you are ignorant about, you must get knowledge about that. Practice of that knowledge is Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. To study and listen to these truths, to reflect upon it and meditate upon it. Remember, each of them has its own result. I'm proceeding in a very systematic way. Each of them has its own result. Study gives us knowledge about these truths. Then we have doubts. Doubts are resolved by reflection. Now we know and we are convinced. But it's not a living reality yet. And that living reality comes from meditation upon it. And the result will be, so problem ignorance, solution knowledge, result is enlightenment. You get knowledge. And remember, keep a mark there. This is entirely the framework of non-dual Vedanta, of the path of knowledge. Because the path of love or the path of meditation will not structure it in this way. In the path of love, you will always put the path of love at the top. How do you get God? By love. So, this is the path of knowledge. But it's interesting to note that even in the path of knowledge, these supporting structures must be meditation and good works, unselfish action, and love of God. There's no contradiction between the search for one's true spiritual self, Brahman, and worshipping God in some way, in whatever religious approach you take. It's extremely helpful. One Swami in Uttarakhand, he said, I don't know how true it is, but I'll tell you what he said. He said, those who are on the path of devotion, for them, talks like this, on the path of knowledge, it may be actually harmful or hurtful for them. Disturbing for them. I love God, I want to worship God and humble myself before God. I'm a servant of the Lord. I don't want to say I am the Lord. So it's disturbing. So the talks on jnana, knowledge, may be a little disturbing for those on the path of bhakti. But the Swami said, for those who are on the path of knowledge, more the bhakti the better. There's no contradiction. Worship God to your heart's content and more than that. The more you do it, the more stronger your jnana will be, your knowledge will be. Cultivate devotion. In fact, knowledge without devotion, without love, is often very shaky. It remains as some kind of not very useful intellectual knowledge. Swami Vivekananda used to say, I'll come to that here. Swami Vivekananda used to say about Sri Ramakrishna and himself, he says, I am jnana outside, inside I am all bhakti. And the old man, he used to say about Sri Ramakrishna, old man, he is bhakti outside, inside he is all jnana. Yes.
Would you say that this Upanishad and in general all the Upanishads are in that framework, knowledge framework?
No, this is a big question. All the Upanishads taken together are Vedanta. Because of this question, there is no one Vedanta. There are many Vedantas, depending on how you interpret the Upanishads. The interpretation which is best known and which we follow, the interpretations of Shankaracharya. They are known as Advaita Vedanta. When Shankaracharya takes these Upanishads, Kathopanishad for example, this book, if you follow these interpretations, you will arrive at non-dual Vedanta, the path of knowledge. But the same Upanishads are taken up by Ramanujacharya, who is the founder of the qualified monism school of Vedanta. He lived 800, 900 years ago. I told you, in India everything is very ancient. So 900 years ago he lived and no, more than that, about 1,000 years ago. He lived 1,000 years ago. It's 1,000 year we're celebrating. So 1,000 years ago. And he himself was ancient. Shankaracharya lived to the age of 32. Ramanujacharya lived to the age of 120, by some accounts. He interprets it in the path of love, bhakti. The same Upanishads. It's called Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. Another path of love interpretation is by Madhvacharya, the path of dualism. Dualistic Vedanta. And there are many other interpretations also. So depending on which approach you take up, which is correct, that is Sri Ramakrishna's unique contribution. It's not that one is correct or the other is incorrect. Rather, they are all correct. Ultimately, somebody asked Swami Turiyananda, one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, what was the philosophy of Sri Ramakrishna in a letter? Somebody asks him. And he answers, a long letter. Is it non-dualism? Is it the path of knowledge? Is it dualism? Is it devotion? Is it meditation? What is the path? What is Sri Ramakrishna's? Because he did all of that. If you see the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, it's full of knowledge and devotion and everything. But the answer of Turiyananda is very interesting. He says, if you ask me for, in brief, what is Sri Ramakrishna's philosophy, I will say that his philosophy is realize God by any means whatsoever. As soon as you can, by any means whatsoever, realize God. Yes.
You are talking about Vedanta, which is like we think that is Advaita. But
yes.
Reach to the Vedanta itself looks like you have the Ganajag, Bhakti Yoga. And if it is Bhakti Yoga, then looks like it's coming to dualism, isn't it?
True. Now, remember, when in Jnana Yoga, in the path of knowledge, when you speak about the path of devotion, always as a subsidiary, it helps. Devotion helps, meditation helps, and good works help, all prepare you for the path of knowledge. Right? So it's not dualism. Ultimately, it is non-dualism, but when you are starting at a dualistic level, when we worship God, how do we worship God? I know at the core of things, at the heart of reality, what is here, it's there too. At this point, let me read out what Yama says to Nachiketa. Very interesting that you should ask this. He says to Nachiketa, it's in the second chapter, in the first section. Yadeveha tadamutra, yadamutra tadanviha, mrityu sa mrityu mapnoti, yahiya iha naneva pashyati. He says, literally what I said to you just now. Is it dualism? God and I are separate? He says to Nachiketa, what is here within you is there too. What is there is here too. And then he says, one who sees the slightest difference between this and that will go from death to death. Mrityu sa mrityu mapnoti. He could have just as well said he would go from birth to birth, but he's not a nice guy. Yama, yama. He says, you will go from death to death. You'll be whirled round and round in this eternal cycle of birth and death. Or as he puts it, mrityu sa mrityu mapnoti. You will attain death, one death to another death. A cycle of deaths only. For what sin? For the only sin of seeing yourself as different from God. Who sees the, he says, slightest difference between oneself, one's real self. Not as Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, not as Nachiketa. But as the consciousness indwelling, the passenger in the vehicle called Nachiketa, the pure consciousness within, that is the same as Brahman. So, ultimately we know that. So then why are you bowing down? Why are you offering flowers? Why don't you go and sit up there in the altar? No. The difference is, as embodied, I am this, and the Lord comes in that form. I am worshipping my true nature in that form. You see, you can see how the object is the same. The core idea is the same. The approach may appear to be dualistic. It's really dualistic if you say that, no, ultimately they are two separate things. God is separate, man is separate, if you say that. But Vedanta doesn't say it. At least non-dual Vedanta doesn't say it. It may apparently be different. Shankaracharya worshipped God in so many ways, as Shiva, as the Divine Mother. Some of the most beautiful hymns are there to God, and it seems very dualistic. I am thy child, you are my mother. It seems very dualistic, but it's based on the non-dual idea. The fundamental is a non-dual idea. How does it work? Hanuman, the great devotee of Ramachandra. Once Ramachandra, who was an incarnation of God, asks Hanuman, what do you think of me? And Hanuman says, Deha buddhya daso aham, jiva buddhya twadangshaka, Atma buddhya tu tvameva aham iti me nishchitamati. And what do you think of me? What's our relationship? He says, Lord, when I think of myself as a body, Hanuman, I am thy servant, you are the Lord. When I think of myself as an indwelling, the passenger in this vehicle who is associated with the mind and intellect and all, not the pure consciousness, then you are the whole of which I am a part. And when I think of myself as pure consciousness, not body, not Hanuman, the pure consciousness, the witness, you and I are one and the same. Which one is right? Iti me nishchitamati. This is my conviction. All three is my conviction. From the point of view of a limited individual, thou art the Lord, I am thy servant. Absolutely, there's no doubt about it. From the point of view of a transmigrating soul, which comes from, goes from body to body, birth to birth, you are the entire universe. I am a tiny part of thee. But I'm a part of you. I'm not separate from you. And as the pure consciousness, the passenger, real passenger in the vehicle, which is separate from the vehicle, the pure consciousness, you and I are the same. This is my conviction. And this was narrated to Sri Ramakrishna, who approved of it. A number of times you'll find it in the gospel. Sri Ramakrishna approves of it. Three levels. Dualism, qualified monism, and non-dualism. Three levels. Beautifully harmonized in the teachings of Shivan. Hanuman speaks about it. Now, let's go ahead. I'm coming now to the core of the teaching, which I'm preserving for the last talk. We haven't started yet. This is the ethical, psychological foundation, essential. Without it, nothing works. Now the core teaching comes up, which I will speak about. I'll just mention it here. Upanishad, as I said, means knowledge. It means knowledge. And where does knowledge come from? Any kind of knowledge comes through inquiry, seeking. Seeking, inquiry. You see, all these Upanishads, they're so diverse. So many things are there. In the Katha Upanishad, you find one thing. In the Kena Upanishad, in the Mundaka, Manduka, they are all approaching the same truth, but in such diverse ways. Now, questions will come. Are they talking at all about the same thing? They're so different from each other. And then a text was written called the Brahma Sutras. Vyasa, who is a famous person in Indian religion, the one who organized the Vedas and so on. So he wrote these sutras, aphoristic sayings, which answers questions about the Upanishads. So they're called the Brahma Sutras. There are these 555 little texts. They look like fragments of sentences. They're compressed sayings, sutras. And the first of the sutras is Athato Brahma Jigyasa. What does it mean? Three words. Atha Brahma Jigyasa, which is a compound of two words. What does it mean? Now, therefore, an inquiry into Brahman. So beginning of spiritual life, he says, is an inquiry into Brahman. All Upanishads are an inquiry. When do you inquire? When you want knowledge. Why do you want knowledge? You want spirituality. Go and worship God. Why do you want knowledge? Well, because spirituality at its essence means we are ignorant about our true selves. We need knowledge about our true selves. And this knowledge comes from inquiry. So this inquiry will reveal to us, what kind of inquiry is it? Primarily, it is an inquiry about ourselves. Who am I? Who are we? That's what Nachiketa was asking when he said, what happens after death? And that's what Yama tells him in these verses. You see, here is the spiritual journey. It's a journey from the... it's an inner journey. Now the vehicle is ready. There's a vehicle, the chariot is there, the charioteer is there, the horses are ready, the reins are in the hands of the charioteer. Remember, chariot, body. The horses, the sense organs. The reins are the mind. And the charioteer is the driver, the intellect. You are apart from it all, still in this body. The consciousness shining upon all of this. Now you're ready for the journey. Where do I go? Nowhere outside. When you go for spiritual life, the first thing that Americans do is look for a visa, you know, take out a passport and you to go to India or Tibet or something like that. You can put that passport away. It's an inner journey. You don't have to go anywhere. You have to go within. Within what? Within this very system where you have the horses and the chariot and the reins and the intellect. You have to go within. What is this going within? It is shifting the eye. Not this eye. The vertical eye. Me. I. Shifting the reference of the eye. What does it mean? When I say, use a word, bottle. Bottle is a word. What does it refer to? It refers to this. Bottle is a word which refers to this object. Right? The word and the object are different. Often we confuse them, the word and the object. Bottle is a word which refers to this object. I is a word. What does it refer to? Straight away it refers to the body. That's what the way we behave. I. When I say I am Indian, it's a nationality of this body. Right? I am I'm a man. Body. Gender belongs to this body. I am a woman. I am a man. I am black or white or brown or yellow, whatever. It refers to the body. That's the I. What else does it refer to? So you will see that real I, the I right now, is referring to the body. And then what happens? The problem, you see, what is the problem with that? The problem is every problem that the body is subject to becomes I, my problem. If I am the body, the problems of the body are my problems. I am the body after all. I am overweight. I am underweight. I am old. Problems of the body, my problems. I am sick. Body's problems. I am mortal, the fear of death. Body's death. It's like standing in an open sewer and complaining, oh, it's so dirty and smelly. Come out of the sewer. Right? You are not part of that sewer. You can't keep on cleaning the drain all the time. It's a drain. Again, dirty water will come into it. The more you clean it, again, it will be a rush of dirty water in it. It's a drain. Body is going to get sick, old, and die. It's part of the nature of the body. Not, as Buddha said, it's impermanent. All that is compounded once will come apart at one time. So, the I, Vedanta tells us, when you say, I am the body, this is what you are getting, this, all these problems. Well, there is a way out. There is a way out because you are wrong. You are not the body. However amazing, however unbelievable this may sound, you are not the body. And Vedanta is going to show you how you are not the body. It's an inner journey, shifting the reference of the I from the body to the spirit. From the changing, aging, diseased, dying body to the immortal, unchanging spirit, which is consciousness, existence, bliss. Changing the reference of the I. You will still say I, but you will mean something quite different from this body. What will be the result of that? Enormous payoff. Enormous payoff. The same Swami Turiyananda, when he was a young boy, he goes to Sri Ramakrishna, who was suffering from cancer. Cancer of the throat. And very painful. And Turiyananda, his name was Hari. He asks Sri Ramakrishna, how are you today, sir? And Sri Ramakrishna says, I'm weak and I cannot eat. It hurts. And Hari says, but I see that you are in great joy. It would be a cruel thing to say to an ordinary person suffering from cancer. And Sri Ramakrishna, instead of feeling hurt, he bursts into laughter. And he says, oh, the rascal has caught me out. Shaladhar in Bengali. Oh, the rascal has caught me out. He's found me out. Another time, Sri Ramakrishna himself, there was another person who was cleaning the wound with a neem, with a solution of an herb, an antiseptic, so that he could feed Sri Ramakrishna. It hurt when he touched the wound. And Sri Ramakrishna gasped in pain. And that person said, he felt hurt. He said, I won't do it then. If it hurts you, I won't do it. And Sri Ramakrishna said, wait. Let me take my mind off from the body. After some time, apparently nothing happened. He said, now you can do it. And that person, Advaitanandaji, he started doing it and absolutely calm. He has not gone into meditation. He's not in samadhi. He's absolutely aware. That means the pain also must be there. But pain, body's pain. That, you see how knowledge works. There are two kinds of insight. One is an insight which you understand that you are apart from this body. Whatever is happening to the body will continue to happen to the body. Old age is happening to the body. It will continue. Disease is there in the body. It will continue. Pain is there in the body. It will continue. And yet, it's not me. No more than the dirty water in the drain affects me when I'm standing outside the drain. I can see that, but it's not me. That's one way. The other way is the yogic way, where you dive deep in the thought of God and you become so absorbed in the thought of God that you actually don't feel it. Both of these you find in Sri Ramakrishna. Sometimes in the jnani's way, in the path of knowledge, sometimes in the path of deep meditation, where his mind is absorbed in samadhi. Sometimes he passes through the phases, one after another. So changing the reference of the I. I'll just say one more thing, and we have run out of time actually. So let's take a question and we'll stop, and then we will come back for the next, after a little bit refreshment. Yes. What must be clear, what are we going to get into now? We are getting into the core of Yama's teaching, the actual teaching about the spirit. How do you shift the reference of the eye? We have covered a long distance. Yes. You can put it that way. Wonderful way of putting it. In the path of bhakti also the same thing is done.
From God dependence to God dependence is
yes. Dvaitam to Advaitam. And there you are not pushing God aside. You realize yourself as, it's a deeper understanding of God, of yourself as one with God. Yes. When you say that you are one with God, what a tremendous thing you're saying. We'll take it up in the next session. We'll conclude this session, yes. Thank you very much. I succeeded. I am a good teacher, so I can observe the class. And just about almost everybody was awake. Some were dozing off. I could see that.
Credit to you.
No, not to me. To them too.
Okay. We'll split the credit. So thank you again. And then we will have a short musical break when he can take some rest and...